Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable, Andrew Tobias, State House and Politics Reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome, Andrew.
Good morning.
Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, great to be here.
And Jesse Ballmert, State Government and Politics Reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks. Happy Monday.
So lawmakers are getting down to the nitty-gritty with the budget bill now. The Senate passed its version last week, a $60 billion plan, and the House is reviewing it. But the two versions do not exactly align. We'll get into the differences between the House plan in a minute, but we'll walk through the Senate plan and see what is going to end up being kept or rejected during conference committee this week. Republican and Democratic senators got into a verbal tug of war over whether the wealthy should get a tax cut by flattening the income tax. Democratic Senator Kent Smith called it, quote, Robin Hood in reverse, unquote, or stealing from the poor to help the rich. And Senator Bill DeMora added this.
Who are the winners? Well, it's simple. Wealthy tax dodgers and corporate welfare recipients. The budget cuts their taxes, funds their stadiums. All the cost of it was paid for by gutting every single safety net in the state. This budget reveals the true Republican agenda.
But Senate Finance Chair Jerry Serino said basically, hold on a minute. Let's listen.
This is ridiculous. These are the people who are creating jobs, creating value, buying property, hiring people, and giving to charities in a big way. So let's be careful about disparaging billionaires or highly successful people. They are an important part of our economy. They pay most of the taxes.
All right, so Republicans want to flatten the income tax, meaning everyone will pay the same percent, 7.27. Yeah, right. That would be so much money if it was 7. 2.75%. And right now, wealthier Ohioans do pay more, so the tax break goes to those who earn more than $100,000 a year. Jeremy, let's start with you. What about Serino's point there? The wealthiest Ohioans are the ones creating the jobs. They're hiring the people. They're giving to the charities. They deserve this cut.
Sure. That's that's one of the that's perhaps the main argument made by Republicans in favor of cutting taxes sort of in general, which is if you lower the tax rate, it will generate more economic activity, and the wealthier Ohioans living in the state are the ones who create jobs and make capital investments. It's part of the trickle-down theory of economics that's been propounded since the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. It's interesting, though, that state business groups have not really called for this tax cut. The Chamber of Commerce and other groups haven't really been vocally calling for it. And even House Speaker Matt Huffman, who supports this, but earlier he told reporters that he hasn't heard any great clamor for it. Same with Governor Mike DeWine. They're both Republicans. This seems to be more ideological, which is we need to get the tax rate, the state income tax rate, down to zero, just because that is something government needs to be small, and we need to get taxes as low as we can get them, which and we can't do that all at once because income taxes bring in $11 billion or so per year to the state, so they can't just overnight get rid of it. But instead, the Senate just kind of cobbled together a way to pay for this by eliminating a lot of tax exemptions and credits and finding spending cuts, and they cobbled together a way to lower this tax rate for people making more than $100,000 a year.
Yeah, Jesse, the point that Jeremy made is the governor didn't propose this, the House didn't propose this, this just came out of the Senate, the idea of flattening the tax. So will it have support from the House and the governor?
Well, I think in the end, they are Republicans, and this has been a Republican agenda item for really years. In the time that all three of us have been covering the legislature, they've been cutting tax brackets, cutting income tax rates. And so this is really just the next step. You also hear Republican Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for governor. One of his big campaign tenets is eliminating the income tax entirely. I know he was like reposting various social media things about this income tax, flat tax. And so I would be surprised if this is something the governor vetoes, even if it wasn't something that he was clamoring for. So we'll see what ends up in this conference committee, which is when the Senate and the House get together and kind of hash out all the differences over the next week or so.
Now, Andrew, lowering this tax will cost the state $1 billion. So the state has to have a balanced budget. So they had to find $1 billion somewhere in order to do this. And one lawmaker compared it to looking under the couch cushions for pennies to try to make this work. Do you agree with that comparison?
Yeah, there's a lot of different cuts to different kinds of programs. H2 Ohio, while the Senate put some money back into that, which is the governor's water quality program, the Senate budget did reduce that. They looked at that. There's lead pipe removal remediation efforts that was defunded. The big item is the governor and the House both had proposed pretty significant spending increases on Medicaid to basically keep up with healthcare inflation. The Senate reduced those below the point significantly that the House and the governor was looking at. And that's just such a huge program that has a big fiscal impact too. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. Did pass unanimously in the Senate among Republicans. Attorney General Dave Yost actually has criticized the flat tax cut. He basically said that if we're going to be cutting taxes for the wealthier people, we need to be doing it for everyone. So it's possible that Republicans might have different views of how much to cut the taxes or for whom to cut them. But like Jesse said, this has been a long-term policy priority. It's one that is important to who many Republicans see as the next governor. So I expect that it will probably survive, but it will be interesting to see where exactly they go to try to, land this.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned the H2 Ohio water program, the lead pipe program. There's a lot of different cuts in many different areas. One of them, the Ohio Senate is cutting $10 million to a child care program out of the budget. Ohioans with young children cite that child care costs are a top priority for them. So, Jeremy, why do you think senators are cutting out this $10 million for child care?
Well, this is a proposed. So when you say cut, it's something that was proposed by the House that they're now taking out.
So the House wants to add the money
they
for child care.
So this is not a currently existing program. This is something that was proposed that they're now removing. And again, it goes back to they were looking for all sorts of ways to balance their budget while incorporating this massive tax cut. And so they just ripped out a whole bunch of what the House proposed. And this was one of them. This was a proposal. It's based on what's going on in other states where it's called a tri-share program, where the state kicks in a certain percent. The employer, participating employers, it's voluntary, would kick in a certain percent, and then the parents would kick in a certain percent, and together that would be used to pay for child care. So instead of paying 100% of child care costs, parents of working for participating companies would only pay about a third or 20% or so of their child care costs. And this, and so $10 million was devoted for a pilot program to try this out, and that was taken out.
Now, this sounds lovely. Can we put it back in? How do we put it back in?
Well, that's up to the conference committee. That's up to the conference committee. And also, I should say, the conference committee isn't they can put in things completely out of left field.
That one has voted on.
They could put in an Amy Jurevich tax cut if
I'll
they wanted
that.
To, 100%, if they wanted to, even though it wasn't in the House or Senate budget. And this is just a handful of negotiators from the two chambers that just meet behind closed doors. And in the next week or two, they'll come out and say, hey, here's what we came up with. And the House and Senate will kind of pass it in pro forma votes, and then it's on to the governor.
Do they do that a lot? Do they add things out of nowhere? I don't know how much history we have around the table of how many budgets you've all covered.
It's limited, but it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they love it. I mean, I don't know what you call it, but where they unveil the omnibus, the mega omnibus amendment, where they're basically putting in the final version of the budget in a committee hearing, they'll just take vote after vote in the conference committee room. They'll just rattle them off, and there will be things occasionally that are introduced that people have never heard of before. So,
how many people get to be in the conference committee? Do you know that?
Officially, there are three from each chamber, two Republicans and one Democrat from the House, and then the same from the Senate. That's not the only six people who are negotiating the results of this budget. Obviously, the governor and his people are going to be involved, and other top leaders from the House and the Senate.
This has very in the room where it happens vibes, like Hamilton-wise, right? Yeah?
Totally. I mean, you have this months-long budget process involving dozens of, you know, hundreds of lawmakers and staff and interest groups and testimony, and it just comes down to, you know, six lawmakers in a room with Jesse said, you know, it's not just them, it's the governor's present and staff are present, but then they're the ones who actually, at the end of this, it all bottlenecks through them about what is kept and what is not kept.
Hmm. Something I just wanted to throw in, too. It's interesting, after Roe v. Wade was overturned, you would hear Republicans in some ways kind of back, like, social policy programs to help fund childcare. You know, at the federal level, they're talking about creating, you know, like a tax credit for new parents and stuff like that. But this budget's a very traditional Republican budget, where kind of the debate that we heard before was kind of the Democrats saying you're trying to cut taxes for the rich, and the Republicans saying, hey, the rich are really actually not that bad. They do a lot of good stuff. So it's interesting to kind of just like see this classic, you know, kind of political debate take place. But yeah, like they're one of the tax exemptions the Senate got rid of, or at least has proposed getting rid of, is a people get a tax deduction for giving money to pregnancy centers, pregnancy crisis centers, where basically pregnant women are discouraged from getting abortion while they're also getting social support and stuff like that. So it's interesting that Republicans are really pushing towards this kind of slice of classic Republican policy to try to cut taxes for wealthier people.
This is All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Andrew Tobias, State House and Politics reporter for Signal Ohio, Jesse Balmert, State Government and Politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter at Cleveland.com. I wanted to turn to education funding for a moment. Senate Finance Chair Jerry Serino told two school officials who wondered about their future funding that they should support the Senate plan, or it could be worse, because there's not a lot of time left to make changes. So can we talk about what does the Senate plan do for schools, and why is it it could be worse?
So I can take a crack at it. School funding is, you know, algebra and calculus and everything combined into one, I would say. Going back a little bit, we started with the Governor DeWine's plan. He said that he was modeling this off this plan that two bipartisan lawmakers worked on about 4 years ago that was approved and was supposedly going to be rolled out over a 6-year period, which is three budget cycles. Since we don't,
which is called
budget,
the fair school funding plan,
yeah,
they like
so
to call it.
They're called Cup Patterson, were the two guys involved, or the Fair School Funding Plan. But DeWine was using kind of like outdated information, and so a number of schools would actually have received less money than they did in the previous year. So schools were not happy about that. So then we go on to the House plan. The House says we don't have money for this Fair School Funding Plan. So they kind of cobbled together their own plan and then included this thing about their kind of version of property tax relief, where if schools were holding more than 30% in reserves, that some of that money would get doled back to property tax relief for those communities. Importantly, schools like Cincinnati that were below 30%, those people would receive no sort of property tax relief, versus like Columbus schools, which was above, might have received a little bit. So that was the House version. Then we go on to the Senate. They kind of like ditch the House plan to a certain extent. They raise that cash reserve to 50%. And so that's where Serino is saying, hey, this is the best you're going to get. I think schools probably don't appreciate that line, but I do think Serino has used this tactic before. I covered Senate Bill 1, which had a prior iteration in the prior General Assembly that advocates were able to block, in part because of like the politics of the House. And he came back with this new bill being like, essentially, this is passing, get on board. And so when you have the votes, you can do that. We'll see where the ultimate school funding formula ends up.
Public school teachers, again, voiced their opposition to this budget plan. Here's Upper Arlington City Schools teacher Ted Hamilton.
Right now, it feels like public education is just a punching bag and an easy target for sometimes privatization, sometimes the removal of local choice.
Andrew, I mean, Jesse did a great job of summarizing three different plans on how to fund schools for the next 2 years, but none of them are the same. So do you think we're going to reach an agreement in this back room where it happens?
Yeah, I would imagine that if the House, I'm just making this up, but yeah, if the House is proposing the 30% limit on how much money schools are allowed to have, and that's 30% of their operating budget, the Senate's proposing 50, maybe they'll meet in the middle and hit 40. You know, big difference between the House and the Senate. The amount of money they spend is pretty similar, although the Senate is a little bit more on K-12 schools, but the House is kind of like, Ohio for a long time has been trying to create a formula that is just predictable and every school district gets X based on what they need. But when they kind of start messing with it, like Jesse said, some schools get less, they don't like it. The House version introduces back what are called guarantees, which is like, it's like, we have this formula, but you're going to get less money, so let's just make sure you don't get less money. And then when they're giving that school district money, there's less money to give elsewhere. And like I said, it kind of lends to a lack of predictability when they're sort of just making ad hoc changes like that. The House wants to just kind of scrap the formula and start over again. I think the Senate is more amenable to trying to keep the formula intact and just hope that those kinds of lumpy things I just described kind of work themselves out over time. So, but meanwhile, it's a big policy priority for some Republicans to cut property taxes. We have a bill that has been introduced on the side that would largely, almost like, not abolish them, but get rid of many property taxes that are used to fund local governments and schools. So it's messy.
And is that a separate bill? That's not
it
in
is
the
a separate bill.
Not in the budget.
There
okay.
is some property tax legislation that made its way into the budget, too. But it's just kind of happening on the sides. And I think that's where school officials really feel like they're up against it, where
That the one that can dictate when schools can ask for levies and that kind of thing?
That's a different one, but that's in the budget. Well, so in one of them, they want to raise.
I thought I knew something.
They want to raise the threshold for how many members of a school board have to vote in order to get a property tax levy on the ballot. So they're just schools are getting squeezed. They're not getting the funding they want. The formula maybe is going to get changed. They're potentially going to be forced to give back a lot of money if they don't spend it, and sometimes school districts hold that money back for long-term financial planning, including for construction. And then also they're expanding funding for private schools. So that's where that feeling comes from. There's a lot of moving parts to it. I mean, ultimately, Republicans do want to spend more money on schools. I think there's like a baseline of support for it. But all these other things are happening at the same time, I think, that are making school officials nervous about what's to come.
Jeremy?
Well, keep in mind, Amy, with all this, all bets are off in conference committee. So you might not be wrong at the end of the day that this, what Andrew said, will be added to the budget. So it's still a wait and see. But just a couple of points of context, too. One is just in general, schools are funded two ways. One is local property taxes, which, as Jesse and Andrew said, they're trying to reform and basically bring down the amount that people pay in property taxes, which obviously would mean less money for school districts. And then secondly, there's state funding on top of that. And that's what we're talking about here, about, you know, the formula for how much each district gets in state aid and things like that. Secondly, so while the Senate is focused on income tax reform and cuts, the House is focused on property tax reform. And part of that is because there is currently a ballot issue or a proposed ballot issue that they're working to get signatures for that would abolish property taxes in the state altogether. They're trying to put that on the ballot. Grassroots organizers are trying to put on the ballot either this November or more likely next year. And so part of something the legislature does in general is when they have a ballot issue that they don't really like, they'll try to co-opt it by passing some reform, like they tried to do that in the past with marijuana and things like that. And so part of this property tax reform comes in that context of an outside effort to get rid of property taxes altogether. So that's something to keep in mind.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about weekend protests. Also, the Ohio Democratic Party has a new chair. And of course, we'll get an update on the latest way to pay for the new Cleveland Browns Stadium. That is when All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With us today is Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com, Andrew Tobias, state house and politics reporter at Signal Ohio, and Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Over the weekend, Ohioans unhappy with the Trump administration's immigration policies and deportations, as well as other policies and DOGE cuts, staged a demonstration at the State House and elsewhere. Westerville, Delaware, Akron, Canton, Cleveland, Cincinnati. This was a part of a coordinated nationwide effort dubbed the No Kings protests, and following on the heels of arrests and unrest in Los Angeles. Everything seemed pretty peaceful around Ohio from what I've read. Andrew, is that what you're reading too?
Yeah, in Cleveland, where my colleague Mark Namick spent some time at the protest on Saturday, I think the kind of tensest moment was actually between different elements of the protests. One of them was larger and organized by local Democratic Party leaders, essentially, and that was more on the theme of, you know, representing President Donald Trump as a threat to democracy and things like that. The smaller group was more focused on criticizing Israel. Obviously, that's gotten a lot more heated over the weekend with the military actions taking place there. So there was actually confrontation between those two groups momentarily, but, you know, it's not like it became newsworthy or anything like that. So it's an interesting illustration of kind of like that dynamic within the left. But otherwise, it was a pretty, you know, uneventful afternoon, other than drawing a pretty large crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here in Columbus, the No Kings demonstration ended up being on Friday, but then there were smaller No Kings demonstrations on Saturday. But they moved the bigger one to Friday because they didn't want it to conflict with the Columbus Pride Parade and Festival, which they kind of overlapped with that some as well here in Columbus. But then I also wanted to move on to Governor DeWine tweeted out related to the Democratic lawmakers who were shot in Minnesota over the weekend. Governor DeWine tweeted, "Fran and I are horrified by the attacks on Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mike and Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. Melissa Hortman and her husband died. The other couple is expected to live. The alleged shooter has been captured. It was captured on Sunday after a massive manhunt." Now, I realize this isn't Ohio Statehouse news, but it does raise a question of safety and security for lawmakers. Do you think after something like this happens, are lawmakers on higher alert in every state? Jesse, do you have thoughts?
I haven't had time to like make calls to see if we've raised security at the Ohio State House or anything, but I'm sure that it hits home for state elected officials who are doing a job and get a lot of angry phone calls and feedback on their positions. And you obviously are hoping that people stick to policy and, you know, not take such an extreme action. I know the two Democratic leaders in the House and Senate issued a statement after the attack, and Minority Leader Russo said that she personally knew the former speaker from Minnesota. And so, again, I'm sure it's weighing heavily on state lawmakers in Ohio.
Yeah, it hasn't happened as much lately, but we have seen protests at the homes of state legislators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one in particular, there was a Jewish state senator from the Akron area, and there was a group that he felt were making like anti-Semitic kind of, you know, like things injected into what they were doing. So I think, you know, at times lawmakers have felt unsafe with that kind of thing. But at the same time, we haven't seen anything like that here in Ohio. It doesn't mean it can't happen, but it would be an interesting question to hear what lawmakers are thinking about this right now.
I mean, at the same time, last month there was a man indicted, a federal indictment for sending white powder and bullets to several Ohio politicians, mm-hmm. including at least one lawmaker. And so when you hold public office, unfortunately, we live in a time of polarization where if you are an elected official on the state level, you are more open to this. And, you know, there's no easy answer. Like, you don't want to deploy like full-time security around your home, but you know, it just leaves people open, unfortunately, to this sort of thing, because you are in the public eye. People are angry. People are disgruntled over something or other. And if you're out there and you're the public face of it, like, I mean, whether you want to or not, whether it's justified or not, people take it out on you. And it's really unfortunate. It's, and there's no easy answer for it, because you're not going to spend millions of dollars to deploy state troopers to all 132 lawmakers' homes.
Yeah. Whenever you said about it, you know, happening here in Ohio, it reminded me back in COVID times at Amy Acton's house, because she was, I mean, she wasn't an elected official. She was an appointee, but she was in charge of the, a lot of the health department policies that were coming out of Governor DeWine's office, and people decided to take it out on her at her house.
Yeah. Yeah. You, when you become the face and the target of people's anger, that can lead to bad consequences. And it didn't, you know, so much in Acton's case, at least that we know of, besides the protests, which, you know, if people are outside your house, obviously that's kind of scary. Mm-hmm. But as far as, you know, death threats or anything more than that, I don't know about that.
This is All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter at Cleveland.com, Andrew Tobias, State House and Politics Reporter for Signal Ohio, and Jesse Ballmert, State Government and Politics Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. I want to pivot back to the budget for a few minutes. Who knew months ago that the issue of the Cleveland Brown Stadium would become a weekly topic on the roundtable? But now there are three different plans floating out there on how to fund a new stadium for the Browns. The contentious debate about sports funding enterprises and whether they should be funding the Cleveland Brown Stadium over, say, Medicaid, schools, libraries. It's been a hot topic. So, Jeremy, let's start with we're now on the third plan for Senate Republicans. Give us a brief overview of what this plan is going to do to fund the stadium.
Sure. So the owners of the Cleveland Browns, Jimmy and Dee Haslam, they want to build a $2.4 billion covered stadium in suburban Brook Park. So they want to move the Browns out of their current lakefront home in Cleveland and move them to a suburb. They want the state to pay a fourth of that cost, or to cover it at least. Mm-hmm. And the state officials, including Governor Mike DeWine and state lawmakers, basically agree, yeah, we're going to give you the money. The only question now in the debate is over how to get them that money. And so, as you said, the governor has proposed a plan. He wants to double taxes on sports betting companies. Mm-hmm. The House wants to issue state bonds. And now the Senate wants to raid the state's unclaimed property fund, where if you have a bank account that you, I don't know, for whatever reason, forget about, or you don't know you have money coming, after a few years it goes into this fund. There's about $4.8 billion in it, and they want to take $600 million out of that. Now, in each of the, in the case of the bonds and the unclaimed property fund, that money would be repaid through taxes generated from the stadium site. Mm-hmm. So players' income tax and every beer you buy, there's sales tax on it, things like that. And now then there's been questions and criticism over whether the Browns' projections of how much revenue that generates is going to live up to what the Browns are saying it will be. But the question right now doesn't seem to be if, but how.
Hmm. Now, Jesse, whenever it comes to this unclaimed funds, did it come as a surprise to find out there was $4 billion in there? Were people like, wow?
Yeah, I think people might be surprised to learn it. If you've ever searched this fund, which you can, the Ohio Department of Commerce, just search unclaimed funds, and you can see if you or your loved ones have any money sitting around in there. I know in previous iterations when they publicized this fund, I found like electric bill deposit for, I don't know, $30 or something like that was sitting there that I had not claimed. Things like that that you maybe don't think about or don't realize you're getting a refund on will end up in this particular place. It's also a lot of people who have passed away or like relatives who might have dementia or something like that, which becomes exceedingly hard to access that money per se.
You can't get the money on behalf of a relative, right? Or maybe you can.
You have to fill out a lot of forms. It's not like you can just show up and be like, my name's Jesse Ballmert, I would like this money. You have to actually prove that it's yours, which is reasonable. So I think because of that, it is just like amassed a large amount. And the idea behind the Senate's plan would be putting $1.7 billion worth of that money that's been sitting there for at least 10 years and allow it to pay for both the Browns renovation. But there are plenty of other sports teams in Ohio, including the Bengals, Paycor Stadium renovations that would like to access that money as well.
Now, Andrew, this idea of using $1 billion from this unclaimed fund to for the stadiums, whether it's just the Browns or the other stadiums too, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there, I don't know, maybe school districts, Medicaid recipients, some libraries, the H2O Ohio Water Quality Program, who would say, use that money, give it back to us, right?
Yeah, I've been kind of surprised that debate hasn't had more of a central place in the State House. We saw it when the House passed their version of the budget with this money for the Browns, which was a different way to pay for it. It was more just like, let's lend them the money and repay it with taxes without involving the unclaimed fund. You saw some Republicans join Democrats in trying to pass amendments that at least they thought would make it harder to make this thing go through. I think it was, if nothing else, a proxy for the political sentiment in the House when it comes to it. I think it's notable that what the Senate has proposed to me seems like it would be something that Governor DeWine likes more, where it does help create a way to pay for other stadiums and not just Cleveland. It's a relatively, I guess you're not really harming anyone by taking the unclaimed funds as long as they pay it back and that kind of thing. I mean, there's a separate question there. So we'll see where the politics of this ends up. But I did just want to point out that there's some fractures in the House on this kind of on a fundamental level. And there's also Americans for Prosperity is a conservative advocacy group here in Ohio. I think they're kind of like really big behind the income tax cut the Senate wants to pass. They don't like giving the money to the stadium. So there are elements within the Republican coalition that don't like this. But it is notable, like Jeremy said, though, that like kind of despite that, the House, the Senate, the governor all agree with the fundamental idea of giving tax money or public money in some form to these stadium projects.
Well, implementing the flat tax is going to cost the state $1 billion. And so instead of making cuts in other programs here and there, couldn't we just take $1 billion from this fund and, you know, even Stevens? I don't know what word to say.
Well, I mean, that's a one-time thing, though. I mean, if you reduce the income tax, every budget, then you have to make up that hole.
You're not wrong. This is, you're paying money to the stadium. It's at the exclusion of other things that the state might want to fund. The thing that comes to mind for me, again, I mentioned earlier, the lead pipe removal. I forget what the number is, but there is a bill out there that would basically help pay to remediate the lead pipes that are in houses all across Ohio and causing long-term health damage to children. Actually, replacing all of it would cost like $15 billion, which is a lot of money. But stuff like that is out there. And then, you know, you have the stadium project just kind of getting dropped into the middle of it. So it is all the same pot of money, and there are limited things they're allowed to do with it.
I mean, the thinking about it is kind of related to what you said at the top of the show about Jerry Serino saying, you know, we need to help the job creators because they're the ones, you know, running the economy and hiring people and getting money out there. And
so the Haslams pay a lot in taxes. So
they,
let's give
they
them
pay
some.
A lot of taxes. And they're the ones, and they're putting up $1.2 billion of their own money. So they're treating this, and they're saying this is one of the largest economic development project proposals in state history. So they're seeing it sort of like as an Intel project where, you know, we're going to help out, and you know, in exchange, we're going to get a rate of return from the new income generated from the site. Now, then there's, you get into the debate about how much of that is just moving from the old stadium, you know, all that economic impact from all the money generated there, and just moving it as opposed to creating it. So you can go down the rabbit hole about that. But the upshot is they're seeing it as an economic development project, not just a, hey, let's, you know, go Browns kind of thing.
Well, just before we can move on, but I want one last question is there's an X factor in this whole puzzle, and it's how Cuyahoga County and the city of Cleveland feel. Are they still going to pitch in their, you said it was divided into quarters?
Right. So the Haslams would kick in half, and then the state and, this is according to the Browns, what the Browns want, and then the state and the locals would each kick in $600 million, and basically the county, including Executive Chris Renane, has had over our dead bodies. So that remains to be seen how they would do it. The city wouldn't kick in, of Cleveland wouldn't kick in any money because they're moving out of the city of Cleveland. So that's a TBD.
Okay. Well, I wanted to move on to Ohio's Democrats have a new leader, Kathleen Clyde. The former representative is the new chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. She is well known in Democratic circles and had the backing of former Senator Sherrod Brown. Here's what she said shortly after her election.
We have time. As a former statewide candidate in Ohio, we have time, and we are working hard to make sure we fill out that ticket, have a candidate in every race, and we have a lot of great talent and great candidates to choose from.
All right. So, Jesse, Kathleen Clyde has a big job ahead of her. She has to basically find candidates to run for just about every statewide office here in Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio Democrats are in an interesting spot right here now because they're mostly waiting for former Senator Sherrod Brown to decide whether he's going to run in the governor's race, the Senate race, or no race at all of which are options for him. And so I think a lot of Democrats are waiting who might be on a statewide ticket to see what he's going to do. They don't want to run against him. Will that make the top of the ticket stronger or more competitive or more money flowing into the state? And so that's why you haven't seen a lot of statewide elected officials signing up, whereas on the other side, the Republicans have it all filled out. And then the other benefit that the Republicans have is they control all but one statewide elected position. And so it's very easy for them to be like, hey, here's our person with past experience who's ready for a new job.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, is Kathleen Clyde up for the job? Does she have the pull in the Democratic Party to get all of the ducks in a row here?
Well, something I thought was kind of interesting how this transpired is that, party officials and politicians are nothing if not like barometers of public opinion, or like at least whatever the, political forces are in the body where they are. So you didn't see, when Sherrod Brown endorsed Kathleen Clyde, a groundswell of executive committee members all kind of flocked to support her. It kind of happened slowly. There was another candidate, Bill DeMora, who you played his comments earlier. He's a state senator. He's a longtime kind of party operator. DeMora ended up dropping out towards the end. He didn't have the votes on the committee is basically what he decided. And you also saw with Kathleen Clyde, influential committee members who represent unions, union leaders, that kind of thing kind of come to her too. So ultimately, she won a near unanimous vote. There was a single vote for another candidate. The party kind of rallied around her. But I thought that there was some interesting kind of like hesitance at first. Now, kind of what she has going for is that she's run statewide before. She was, raised a good amount of money when she ran for Secretary of State in 2018. I think she's known to some of the key kind of like leaders in labor, and particularly in kind of Sherrod Brown's orbit. So I think that she's a known commodity and kind of like has relationships and trust within some members of Democratic leadership. But yeah, I thought it was interesting that there wasn't more of a push to her at the beginning, even as Sherrod Brown, backed her. And he's by far the most influential person in the Democratic Party here.
So there's speculation among many Democrats that the reason that Sherrod Brown wants Kathleen Clyde in there is he is looking to run for governor or at least some statewide office next year. And he wants the person in charge of the state party to be someone that will work with him as opposed to work against him. That remains to be seen, of course, whether he's going to run. Kathleen Clyde's election comes as there is a debate within the Democratic Party, not just within Ohio, but nationwide. There's a lot of discontent among rank and file voters over Democratic leadership saying, hey, we're getting our butt handed to us. You guys got to get mad. We got to have a platform that actually wins people over because we're losing. And instead of doing that, Bill DeMora kind of campaigned on I'm going to run and I'm going to be a street fighter, he said, and I'm going to be really, really take it to the Republicans. And instead, Kathleen Clyde is, and we'll see how she actually does, but at least on paper, she enters as someone who's going to kind of continue what the Ohio Democratic Party has been doing, which is shore up their finances internally, but sort of keep these protesters, like we were talking about earlier, these more left protesters at arm's length. And we'll see if that works out for them.
If we're waiting for Sherrod Brown to make a decision and then everything is going to like trickle down from whatever it is that he decides, if he's going to be at the top of the ticket or stay out of it completely, does he need to hurry up? I mean, like, isn't this is the time to be raising some money, or is it still, it's really far away?
So I remember in 2018, which Democrats at that time agreed that it was a good political climate. They thought they could win. At that time, people saw Donald Trump's election as more of a fluke, I think, than kind of like a new fundamental realignment of politics, which we've kind of clearly more view it as today. Rich Cordray didn't get into that election until around Labor Day. There was a kind of the same story about, you know, he had a federal position that he worked for the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau in Washington that prohibited from running for office. So there's kind of like some background stuff. I don't, you know, it's been too long. I don't remember if he just had to like sign a new lease in Columbus or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he had the time that he needed to run the campaign. I think that's kind of what the point that Kathleen was making when she was asked about that, that it's not unusual for Labor Day to kind of, for Democrats, especially because of the union events that take place, so that kind of be like when you have your candidate slate kind of in place. However, Republicans have been lining up to run for office for years. It kind of shows the confidence that they have where there's no shortage of candidates who want to run. So clearly Democrats are kind of behind in terms of just like the longer that you're in place, the more money you can, the more time you can raise money, you can like kind of hire staff and do all the kind of planning. But I think they do have time, but it is very clearly that, or it's very clear that Sherrod Brown's kind of just hanging over the whole thing, and everybody else is going to make decisions based on what he does.
Go ahead. Sorry, yeah, quick addendum. Sure. Rich Cordray got into the race in December of 2017, which I think everyone conceded was too late to make a real run at it against Mike DeWine.
Oh, so just remembering the timing there?
It was a little bit later. So if Sherrod Brown waits till December, Democrats probably have a problem.
That seems like such a long time from now. All right, we'll see. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be back in just a moment.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us is Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com, and Andrew Tobias, statehouse and politics reporter at Signal Ohio. Republican Representative Josh Williams is sponsoring a bill to require a 24-hour waiting period before an abortion, even as an existing law related to that same subject is being challenged in court. What's his argument for introducing a bill when Ohio already has an existing law, albeit one that's being challenged? And didn't Ohioans overwhelmingly vote for reproductive rights in 2023? So, Jesse, can you basically explain to us why Josh Williams is sponsoring a bill when there's already a law?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was pitched by Representative Williams and also a new representative from the Cincinnati area, Mike Odioso, who replaced Bill Seitz, a longtime lawmaker. And essentially, they would want to require some sort of notification at least 24 hours before you obtain an abortion. A slight differentiation is this could be via email. It wouldn't have to be in person, which is what the current law was. The 24-hour waiting period is something that abortion rights advocates fought against for quite some time, saying that it wasn't necessary, saying that there was already, every doctor is going to give you information about a procedure or a medication before they're giving it to you, and that this was kind of like a necessary step. And so it was challenged in court and at least preliminarily put on hold. Another one of the arguments against it is it rarely ends up being just 24 hours, because if you have to have an in-person appointment where you get information and then maybe you don't have transportation or childcare or your work schedule to come back exactly 24 hours later. And so it's an interesting play from these Republican lawmakers to try to get at something that ostensibly is being worked out in the courts right now.
And I mean, Ohioans voted for reproductive rights to ensure access to abortions in 2023. So how does this factor in with that vote by Ohio?
Yeah, so I think you're going to see Republicans saying sure, Ohioans want access to abortion, but we can regulate it in these various ways. Abortion rights advocates are going to say the regulations that you're trying to put in here are making it harder to access reproductive health care in Ohio. And so those are the things that we're going to see going back and forth. Also, some portion of these cases are going to end up before the Ohio Supreme Court, which right now has 6 Republicans and 1 Democrat. And so I think a lot of people are eager to see how that body is going to interpret this constitutional amendment. And the more laws you put in place that might be at odds with that, the more you might be forcing a challenge.
All right, moving on to another topic before we run out of time. Jeremy, county coroners are now elected. And at one point, there was a plan to have county commissioners appoint the coroners instead of electing them. But now the Senate has dropped that idea. What is with this debate? Why did we have this come up where whether coroners should be elected or appointed?
So this is one of the myriad number of topics that the House and the Senate are going to have to work out in conference committee, because the House proposed having county coroners be appointed by their respective county commissioners instead of being elected, as you said. And the rationale behind that, they said, is that it's hard to recruit people to run for coroner because under the law, you have to be a physician and, you know, we want qualified people in there. But they say that a lot of counties have trouble recruiting physicians who are qualified and who are willing to go through the whole hassle of running for political office to get elected. I mean, especially because, you know, I mean, what's the difference between a Democratic coroner and a Republican coroner? One of the job involves basically determining cause of death for any unusual, sudden or violent death. And so that was the rationale behind it. But the Senate said, well, the system, you know, kind of works OK now and we didn't see a whole big need to change it. And so if it ain't broke, no need to fix it. And so we'll see what the conference committee comes up with.
One more issue I wanted to be able to touch on is iGaming. We talked about that for a couple of weeks here on the roundtable, and basically iGaming was allowing you to there's iGaming and iLottery, and it's allowing you to do more things on your phone when it comes to gambling. Andrew, that where does it stand on where iGaming is? Because it was supposed to be, if it made it into the budget or if the bill passed or whatever, it was going to be an infusion of money, right?
Yeah, I think that was probably the case, especially that gambling interests were making as the Senate was trying to find the coins in the couch cushion to pay for their tax cut, as we talked about earlier. We kind of saw Senate Republicans walk away from the issue. They essentially said that why rush this? We don't need the money that badly. We want to be deliberate. You know, we don't want this urgency to be at the expense of good policy and that kind of thing. I'll still believe it when I see it, when the budget is done and this is not in there. I just kind of see this as an issue that has a very active kind of special interest backing it. So we'll kind of see where it lands. But that's what they said. And at this time, you know, it's not in the budget and may end up being something that the legislature picks back up later in the fall.
Okay. And one other thing I wanted to touch on, which I think was a separate bill. I don't maybe parts of it are related to the budget, but where are we on when it comes to marijuana? There was a whole, I mean, I did a whole hour show on bills that were being proposed related to regulating and changing marijuana and changing what Ohio voters voted on a couple of years ago. Where does it stand with the marijuana bill?
So we spoke with Speaker Matt Huffman last week, and he says this is something that he wants to get done before the end of June. It's not included in the budget, but I think you could see a vote on a package of legislation as soon as this week.
This week? Okay. Yeah. All right. So while everyone's busy in the conference committee, we also could see marijuana legislation pass.
Yeah, we're going to try to walk and chew gum at the same time.
All right.
Major pieces of legislation moving through the Ohio General Assembly.
Okay, well, we have like 2 minutes left. So while the budget is in conference committee this week, and we talked a lot about the budget throughout this hour, I wanted to ask each of you if there's something in the budget that you're watching most closely to see if it stays in, to see if it changes, if, you know, whenever that, like, what is it, a 700-page document, bigger than that? I don't know.
Oh, 5,500 pages?
Oh, great, yeah. When that giant document comes out, what are you looking for? Who wants to?
There's all kinds of policy. Like, it's shocking how many items that usually people would think would be passed in separate bills are just kind of tossed into this. So something that I'm looking at, for example, is the House passed
language that critics worry will allow almost all police records to be exempted from public records law. And apparently a compromise was worked out between the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, which was seeking this, and criminal justice reformers who were very opposed to this. And but again, it's all up to what is conference committee going to do. So I'm going to be looking to see what they're going to do.
All right. Anyone else have anything you're looking for?
Yeah, my issue is a good example, just like the nitty gritty of things that are in this. So the Republicans a year or so ago banned quote unquote foreign nationals, which they made a point of including permanent lawful residents, also known as green card holders, from giving campaign contributions to state ballot issues. There was a whole backstory about how some of the left-leaning ballot issues we've seen in Ohio were funded by a particular group that had ties to a Swiss billionaire who lives in America now. Well, so the budget, after they did that, it would explicitly grant green card holders the right to give money to political candidates. And I'm wondering why, if they can't give to ballot issues, do you want to actively give them the right to give to political candidates? So still don't really know what that thing's doing in there, but it interests me as somebody who follows ballot issues especially really carefully.
All right. And in 10 seconds, Jesse, you have anything you want to look for?
Oh, campaign finance reform, whether students who get this scholarship still have to stay in Ohio 3 years afterwards. There's a lot to look for.
All right. Thank you to Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you.
Thanks
and
so much.
Thank you, Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio. Thank you.
Happy to do it.
And Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.